Thank you, choir, for that Moses Hogan anthem. I love a Moses Hogan anthem. We lost Moses just a few years ago, but his work and his words live on, and they always bring life to our worship. You remember when Paul says in the Bible, "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels." Remember that? Or as you may be accustomed occasionally to hearing it from our pew Bibles, "We have this treasure in clay jars." Ever wonder why he said that? One person has pointed out that we all kind of know when something just isn't right. And deep down you know it. Something is not right in your life, in the world, in your church. Things just don't line up. Well, something was off in the Corinthian church. Paul had already made his extended visit, the one where he actually lived there and worked for 18 months. Now there were letters flying back and forth between the apostle and the church. 1 Corinthians isn't actually first. We don't have the very first letter, but it is referred to. 2 Corinthians seems to be a compilation of letters or fragments of letters, best they could put some pieces together. And so today our text comes from that collection in our New Testament. Paul gave them some instruction in this letter. The Corinthians loved Paul, but this relationship by now was with them like a lot of relationships churches have with their pastors. Love and respect until we say something you didn't want to hear. Well, y'all are like the early crowd. It's okay. You can grin. It's okay. Don't have to be uneasy. Suddenly, when that happens, we are incompetent or out of touch or we just don't get it or something else. Once that happens, the next fancier or hipper looking or dynamic sounding voice becomes the new de facto pastor. Maybe someone even that you watch on television who's got to know what they're doing because they have a big old church. And that many people, along with the TV ministry, just couldn't be wrong. So Paul is living into an awkward chapter of life with his church he planted at Corinth. The Corinthians had pushed back at Paul in their responses to his letters. They didn't like what they were hearing. And pretty soon some other voices wrapped in more interesting, more appealing, more open-minded packages had come along. And then some of the people had decided they were going to stay with Paul. But others of the people had squared off against them, siding with some of these other voices within the congregation, thinking that Paul's time had passed. Paul countered by trying to speak with them about relating to each other constructively. Seems that didn't even slow them down. In a beautiful article on Paul's time at Corinth, Douglas Campbell points out that some thought Gaius ought to be the new leader. Others sided, though, with Crispus or Erastus or Sosthenes. These were all local converts that Paul himself had led to Christ during his time there. Now, though, these upstarts who hadn't even been to seminary were tussling for the pastoral controls. The church at Corinth was a mess, but not just because of that. So I want to take you on a journey for the next few minutes. But it's a journey that's going to be better taken if we all imagine ourselves joining hands and holding hands for the duration. Going up one side of the hill and seeing what's at the top and then coming back down that hill together. I'll let you stop off at a couple of points along the way. And by the time we arrive at the end, I think it's going to be a pretty interesting place to be. But you'll have to stay with me. If you lapse into making the grocery list for Food Lion a little later, you're going to lose all of this. So come with me as we drill down and see what was happening to this church at Corinth that Paul was writing a letter to. In 1 Corinthians alone, Campbell counts at least 15 specific problems that put the Corinthians at odds with Jesus Christ and Paul and within themselves. This partisanship around the preachers I mentioned or the leaders at that congregation was a problem. But so were a variety of marital, extramarital, and celibacy practices. The adults were behaving like children. There were some extracurricular family practices that were simply out of bounds to Paul, but not to some of the Corinthians. They were divided by lawsuits between them on other matters. Idolatry was mixing its way into their religious practices. They had chaos in worship. They had divided around their nation's leadership. Some thought it was okay, just like it was. Others felt displaced, though. They felt powerless against both a cultural tide they no longer understood and an institutionalized way of being that quite literally felt foreign to them. They had also divided generationally. Some were on board with the more open-minded and free ways of being. Others, though, were pretty sure that nothing good was going to come of these new ways. The wealth was concentrated in roughly the top 1% of people. And yet Paul had established a church that attracted a wide variety of people along socioeconomic lines, so people with less resented those with more, and people with more looked down upon people with less, and that affected how they valued their humanity, it seems. Campbell says, and this sounded starkly familiar, that the bitter partisanship evident at Corinth was linked tightly with another feature of the community. Life in the ancient city was now a desperate struggle for survival and an equally desperate climb up the proverbial greasy pole to the top. Economically and socially, they sat on people below them while they fought off their rivals ruthlessly. Beauty and expression were valued almost above anything else. How someone looked, how attractive they were, and how soothingly or dynamically they spoke was valued far above what they actually had to say. If one could package their message effectively enough so as to be most appealing, they could almost have their way with the Corinthian listeners. There were fierce defenders of the fledgling orthodoxy, and there were fierce defenders against opposing beliefs. And some of them had dug in with hard positions that had become as much about winning as about what they believed. This brought about narrowness and division that really held them back from being or doing much of anything. Oh, I know what you're thinking. You think I am making a parable and have lapsed into the ways that people characterize our divisions here in America today, don't you? Nope. This is all about Corinth in the first century. Every bit of it, no matter how familiar it may sound. But since it does sound a little familiar, don't you think you ought to sit forward and hang with me now to see what there may be in this that we can get any good out of for our day and time? Campbell says that so many of the problems in Corinth, and he suspects in many other places, would be solved if Christians were simply kinder to one another and to people outside their faith. Oh my. That sounds too simple for you, doesn't it? Well, don't let it. And don't miss the bigger thing that's at stake with the Christians at Corinth. That's right, we need to remember that most of this whole story that I've told you is about Christians. Christians had made this mess in the church at Corinth. In the first Corinthian letter that's in our Bible, Paul had said, love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. Love is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongdoing. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. love never fails. And we read those words at weddings and we dab at tears because it's all so perfect and promising and beautiful. But well as they may fit that happy occasion, Paul didn't write those words for the joining of couples in love. He wrote them trying to save a church that was coming apart at the seams. The messy, imperfect, human, stumbling church needed what Paul had to say in the words we've nicknamed the love chapter in 1 Corinthians. Corinth's lessons get more sobering before they get better for modern Christianity in America. For a time, the church wasn't very appealing to others there. They could tell that things over at the church were a mess. They knew when they came in contact with folks whose lives didn't seem to match their message. They could tell when they were dealing with a Christian from the Corinth church who was so mean, so dug in, so puffed up that they just didn't want to be around folks like that. Then there were those who were a lot like the misbehaving Corinthian Christians. They could tell when they were around someone from the Corinthian church who was just as bad as they were. And that didn't represent Christ too well either. The church wasn't appealing to them, didn't have much to offer to them. They could skip the hypocrisy and just live the way they wanted to in honesty. So as we pick up Paul's message in 2 Corinthians, he is appealing to the church to get its act together because the message of Christ was now being veiled. His words. Folks just couldn't see much to the message or to the church of the message that made sense for their lives. But Paul still hadn't given up. So he told the church about what he thought was the only thing that stood a chance to sort all this out. The face of Christ. His message is a message of focus. The apostle wasn't going to compromise his focus. He believed that Corinth's best chance, the church's best chance, the world's best chance was to hear the gospel and to respond. It's a little subtle, but he actually appeals to every person's conscience. He effectively dares them to remember back to his time there among them, to think of what he has said and written, to draw from his associates who have come and gone since then, and to make other visits to Corinth possible one day. In the end, he believes deep inside of all of them that they know which voice, which message is reflective of the way that works, Christ's way. As for the witness, the message of the gospel that has been hindered unto being veiled as a truth, well, that may be the worst part yet. Because the church has all but lost its chance. Instead, what he calls the God of this world has stepped into the opportunity and has lured those who were looking for something. Those who might have believed in Christ and become a part of God's kingdom, but for now were given over to their own more appealing excesses. Paul said that his clear message of Christ didn't point very well to selfish fulfillment, didn't point to shiny, distracting, but hollow treasures. For we do not proclaim ourselves. We proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord and ourselves as your slaves for Jesus' sake. The light that promised to shine out of the darkness was this loving, giving way. And though it's not part of today's text, that very next verse, verse 7, that you know from heart, is where Paul uttered those famous words, "For we have this treasure in earthen vessels," or clay jars, in other words. The church is under assault today, much as in Paul's time, largely for having made itself pretty irrelevant. These earthen vessels can crack so easily if we don't watch it. Lillian Daniel, in her book, Tired of Apologizing for a Church I Don't Belong To, knows that the question then and now is, why bother? She says these days it's a little countercultural to suggest that anyone might benefit from the company of others in the life of faith, particularly others who have gone before us in ancient times. It's much easier to point out the blind spots of our ancestors in the faith, their missteps. But we can still learn from the cloud of witnesses who went before us. So when we hear complaints about Christianity and the media critics and atheists and others who paint it with a broad and bigoted brush, why don't we object? Why don't we tell them a different story, Daniel says, of a progressive church where your questions are welcomed, but where we learn from a tradition older than ourselves, where we worship a God who invented us and not the other way around, where we gather in a church not to lure in and entrap God, but to take God seriously in the company of others who share this faith. Why don't we tell them a different story? Why don't we tell them a different story? Of course, our challenge is the challenge that the Corinthian church had. It'll have to be true first. Like Lillian Daniel, I'm tired of apologizing for a church I don't belong to as well. And to tell the kind of story that she proposes, we'll have to make sure, each one of us, that we're living differently than the people at the Church of Corinth. What are you doing to be sure that the face of Jesus Christ is what we are showing each other and that we are showing to others around us today? What are you doing to be the kind of church Lillian Daniel believes would make a different kind of story? I want to remind us all that Douglas Campbell says this: so many problems in Corinth, and I suspect in many other places, he says, would be solved if Christians were simply kinder to one another and kinder to people who are outside the church. There it is. And I need to let that message seep into my very bones as much as anyone hearing me today. Oh, I know the ancient church we've heard about had a complex, multi-layered set of problems. I made the case to you about that earlier. And I know today seems like it gives us more to differ on in our culture than to unite around. But Campbell and Lillian Daniel and the Apostle Paul, they call us all in exactly the same way: to be nicer to each other. Really? Yes. And to value the church even more than we value our intellectual or convictional or political positions at times. And that isn't easy. And to understand, and this is so hard, to understand that sometimes if we think we're winning the point by being right, we are probably losing the person also by being so obnoxiously right. Mean-spirited Christians do not draw people to the church. To use Paul's language, they only help to veil the gospel to others. And they call us to get out, all of these writers call us to get out of our comfort and make a hospitable place for others and for God. For this may be the only chance we have at seeing that the church lives on for even one more generation. We are big fans of Paul's words that he wrote to the church at Corinth. I'm convinced of it. I'm not sure how much we actually believe the words, though. I'm not sure how much we value them as relevant to what we call the real world. Ironically, that's what church folks refer to when they're about to disagree with the gospel of Christ. We like these words read for us in a sweet ceremony. We like them embroidered on a throw pillow. I'm not sure how much we trust them with our living compared with just letting it all hang out and then calling that being honest. We sure hope that someone else is hearing this, but we rarely remember it is we who need to hear it most. Know what the church most needs to hear one more time? Well, I'll read it, because I sure need to hear it, even if you don't. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. Love is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongdoings. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. We have a hymn of response. It's hymn number 161 in our books. See our Lord in all His glory. We have a chance to sing about the face of Christ as we experience it in our faith. There may be someone who has a decision they want to record down here with me. There may be someone who's ready to trust Christ anew as Lord of their life. Or you may have a response you want to make right there where you are. In all those cases, as you're able, let's stand and sing hymn number 161.